Hello and welcome to the second installment of the IASA Legal Podcast, part of the expanded legal resources for IASA members during this year. My name is Chad Watkins, the IASA Legal Counsel. As a reminder, each episode of the IASA Legal Podcast will feature an interview with a school law attorney with expertise in a particular area. Today's guest for our second legal podcast is Courtney Stillman, an expert in legal concerns related to students.
Hi, I just want to thank you for inviting me to be on this podcast. I'm excited to talk with you this morning.
Great. We're excited to have you here. For all of our guests, Ms. Stillman concentrates her practice in the areas of special education and disability law. She is licensed to practice in both Illinois and Indiana. Before joining Hauser, Izzo, Petrarca, Gleason, and Stillman, LLC, Ms. Stillman represented parents of students with disabilities for 10 years. Prior to that, she practiced in the areas of tax and corporate law. Ms. Stillman was a member of her local Board of Education for 11 years and president of that school board for 6 years. She has also served as a trustee on our local public library board for 6 years. Ms. Stillman earned a BA in political science from Manchester College in 1989 and graduated summa cum laude from Indiana University School of Law in 1992. In law school, she was an articles editor for the Indiana Law Review and received the Faculty Award for Outstanding Scholarship, Leadership, and Contributions to Development of the Law School. Since November 2010, Ms. Stillman has been recognized as an Illinois leading lawyer in the area of school law. So, Courtney, we're very happy to have you here. As you know, school is back in session across the state, and it looks like no other school year before. We have students learning remotely, we have students learning in person with appropriate health and safety measures, and we have students doing a hybrid of both. Our new learning environment brings new challenges and legal concerns for our districts. So to help sort through those concerns related to our students, we have you here today. So to begin, Courtney, can you give an overview of the biggest student legal issues districts are facing?
Well, Chad, I think that basically it's ones that we're going to be discussing today. I've had a lot of questions regarding student confidentiality with our teleconferencing platforms, both from the standpoint of student records and observing it and recording sessions, and then also teachers recording sessions and posting those and how that is a student records concern as well. Also, we're going to be talking about keeping students safe, and obviously with all of the Department of Public Health and ISPE guidance with regard to face coverings, social distancing, the temperature checks and symptom screening. There's a lot involved with keeping our students safe. And then a lot of questions, since I do special education law, on providing a free, appropriate public education in the least restrictive environment, which is drastically changed, for students who have IEPs, and what that free, appropriate public education looks like now, how we provide prior written notice to parents with regard to how we're implementing all or parts of their IEPs during remote learning or hybrid learning.
All right, so let's dive right in. For students that are learning in person, what are the most important health and safety considerations the district should keep in mind for their students?
Well, I think basically the social distancing that we're required with the 6 feet apart and the face covering requirements. Also, as I mentioned before, we have the temperature and symptom checks, and then being able to trace contacts if someone becomes ill. We have the requirement to notify the Department of Public Health, and there are the tracing contacts of who's been in contact with this person who has now come down with symptoms, who's been exposed for 15 minutes throughout the school day. The other thing that's been an issue with schools that I work with, we're accommodating students who can't wear the face coverings. So we had the guidance that a student could have a medical exemption if they either had a health concern, such as a breathing issue that they could not wear the mask, or potentially, for example, a student with autism might have sensory concerns. There might be behavioral concerns that the physician would indicate that the student couldn't wear a face covering. So we were looking at things like having some partition around their desk, looking at maybe doing some desensitization. Could the student wear the face covering part of the day, although not all of the day? But then the other thing that was interesting that came out then recently was in Illinois Department of Public Health guidance indicating that if a student could not wear a face covering, but we were offering in-person instruction to other students, that we were required to offer in-person instruction to that student, even though they could not wear the face covering. And previously in the ISBE guidance, it talks about making individualized determinations so that there might be some students, due to their health concerns or behavioral issues, might be such that we would not be able to keep that student safe or others from attending school, and making an individualized determination that even though we do offer in-person instruction, that this student should continue to receive remote instruction. So that Illinois Department of Public Health guidance made some changes, at least for the schools I work with, from what our original plan was, and caused some concern with some students. But I think that those face covering requirements, the social distancing, and again, all the symptom checks and the self-reporting of that, I think is another issue, because we have students and parents putting in their own reports on that. And then again, the complications of doing that contact tracing.
Sure. Now, what about for students that are learning remotely? I know, and you mentioned it in your introduction, that you know, a common concern is protecting student record information, either when parents are in the background or using these digital platforms that maybe districts don't have much experience with, like Zoom or Google Hangouts. How do you suggest districts navigate those student privacy concerns?
Okay, well, we've had a number of concerns, for example, from related service professionals about even using the platforms. But we're recommended by both the U.S. Department of Education and the Illinois State Board of Education to use these platforms. Schools are not subject to HIPAA, but even back in March, when we ended up with school closure, there was some relaxation of HIPAA requirements for professionals more in the medical or private field than school to allow for using these platforms for therapy. Also, in the most recent recommendations from ISBE for remote learning, they recommend synchronous learning, which is that the student or students, plural, and the teacher or other service provider are live and in communication at the same time, which you would need this teleconferencing capacity for, and with the recommendation that that's at least 2.5 hours per day. So it is recommended to use these technology platforms, and a lot of schools, you know, at first when we closed down, we just used packets or had less sophisticated means of doing it. And I think schools are more sophisticated in their remote instruction with the coming school year. So the concern and confidentiality with that is disclosing any personally identifiable student record information about a student. And that would be information that's directly related to the student and from which a reasonable person could personally identify that student. And under the Student Records Act, we are not allowed to provide that personally identifiable information without consent of the parent. And then if it has to do with mental health information, we would also need the student's consent if they are age 12 or older. Now, there's no problem with directory information, assuming that the parent didn't opt out, which are things like the name, the student's name, their address, their parents' name, their email, their cell phone number. And the Office of the U.S. Department of Education that deals with FERPA has also indicated that there is no, although there is a directory information opt-out provision, you cannot opt out of your name and your school email within the class that you're enrolled. So we're not worried about that someone hears the student's name. It would be personally identifiable information, for example, something in the student's IEP. So, for example, we don't want teachers saying, oh, Johnny, will you have the accommodation of extra time? So everyone else's assignment is due tomorrow, but you get 3 days. So that's that type of thing. Now, one of the concerns, so in March of 2020, the U.S. Department of Education put together a PowerPoint and a presentation that related to many of these issues and FERPA, the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act. And they went back to an old ruling, this letter to mamas, that says that if you're observing students, that's not a student record violation, because the concern was the students in their home doing their instruction, but the parent walks by and sees another student in the class. Or the student's brother walks by and, you know, and sees this other student and hears them. And so the U.S. Department of Education reiterated that just observing a student is not a student records violation. The problem, again, comes in if the teacher inadvertently would provide this personally identifiable information without consent. So many schools are asking parents not to observe unless it's necessary. With some of the schools, I've seen some forms where we're asking parents not to observe at all. With regard to particularly students with disability, I'm not sure how realistic that is, because some students may need assistance from their parents to get logged on, to participate, to maintain attention. We've also been helping parents with behavioral type of interventions during the sessions. So for example, maybe the parent would use a token board so that if the student continues to participate in the program, they might be getting tokens during this. So I think it's unrealistic to always expect that the parent won't observe. And the U.S. Department of Education has said that we can observe. However, it is important to tell parents not to record these sessions or be posting them on social media or something inappropriate like that, you know, posting it to the public. With regard to recording, there are some instances for, there are a couple of examples I can give. One is, let's say the instructor gives that synchronous lesson, but wants to record it for reference. And this could be reference of students who were unable to attend that day, or it could be this is the complications on how to do this math problem when we're going to have a test. So I'd like to have this posted for students in my classroom so that they can go back and reference it kind of as a study guide, for example. Mm-hmm. And so we are, according to the U.S. Department of Education, able to record these sessions. My advice would be to try to record the instruction and just the teacher or related service provider themselves and attempt to the extent possible not to record other student faces or voices. But the guidance is that we can record these. However, they should be accessible, the recording should be accessible only to students within that group or class. So it's not, so if we're working with fifth graders, it would, and Mrs. Jones is doing the instruction and recording it, that instruction is available to Mrs. Jones' fifth grade class, not Mrs. Smith's fifth grade class, not the entire school building, but just to the class that she's working with. The other guidance is to have this recording on a secure site. You might have it password protected so that those students in that class or group that received the instruction would have a special access code or passcode to get onto that recorded lesson. And the other thing is to maintain that recording, have it posted for only a limited time. Now, I'm not sure what a limited time is, but the concern is that, at least under FERPA, if you have a recording that has various students on it, that can become a joint student record. And then you could have various parents asking to see it, for example. And it's a student record if it's got that personally identifiable information and it's maintained by the school district. So in order to not be maintaining these recordings as potential student records, we only keep it for a limited time. So I'm going to have this math instruction for your math test, but it's only going to be on the secure site for a week, and then we will be taking our test on this topic, and then this recording is not going to be available. The other thing is that if we are recording, that the teacher, if something inappropriate were to happen during this, for example, in the student's home, we see something in the background, or the student starts doing something inappropriate, to stop the recording. So that information is not on there. Or you could also edit the recording before it's posted. So then the question is, do we want to get consent of parents for their children to be involved in these video conferencing sessions? And so the safest answer is yes, because then if there is some inadvertent disclosure of personal information, then we've got the parent consent for the child's participation. I've had some districts, and I think it depends on your population. I think some districts believe that they're going to have the parents are going to return the consent. I've had some other districts that say, I'm concerned that I'm going to, the contact with the parents and the community maybe isn't as good, and they're concerned that they're going to get these consents back. That would be the safest approach to get consent for the student to participate in these video conferences. The other guidance that the U.S. Department of Education put out was a question about, well, if we're learning and teaching remotely, can teachers and related service providers take a student's records home? And the answer was, yes, you're a school official who has an educational or administrative interest in the student, and you're using the records in furtherance of that interest. And then the concern, guidance is, of course, don't be sharing that information from the student records with other family members. And also when you're doing the video conferencing, that you would go to a private place in the home or have your work area a good place to be able to provide this instruction or related service. And one other thing that I want to mention on this is the PTAC, the Privacy Technology Specialized Center under FERPA, does have a variety of requirements and guidance documents with regard to student privacy with technology. So for example, in addition to the video conferencing, we may be using some online educational programs. And these apps and various programs need to follow both state and federal privacy laws. And PTAC has a number of requirements for agreements. And there's things like if any of the information is taken from the student through this online application, it can't be redisclosed. It's owned by the school district. If there's any kind of data breach, the school has to be informed of this. So before a teacher or related service provider would want to use an application, they need to make sure with their school technology department that this is something approved. One of the examples that that PTAC gives is these click wrap agreements, where, you know, I'm sure we've all seen those. You want to access something online, and there's a bunch of small print, and then at the bottom it says, "I agree," and that's called a click wrap agreement. So if you just, you know, I'm sure many of us don't want to spend 10 minutes reading all the fine print and just hit "I agree," but without reading that, you don't know if this particular educational application would be consistent with those student privacy laws. So we don't want teachers to be hitting click wrap agreements or finding these materials without consulting with their technology departments to make sure that these particular online technology services will meet the requirements for student privacy. And then to just make sure that we're following all of our technology procedures within the district. And that's another thing to give parents notice of, is that they need to follow the board policy with regard to technology, and then also that student code of conduct is going to continue to be in place, and we're going to enforce any cyberbullying policies, that type of thing.
Sure. All right. Well, thank you very much, Courtney, for your response there. Changing gears a bit, what about special education? How can districts ensure that they're providing a free, appropriate public education for all students when learning looks so different this year?
Well, basically, we have to do the best that we can under the circumstances. It's depending on the student's IEP goals, it may be difficult to implement every single goal. And that was, again, I think we're getting more sophisticated as we're continuing our remote learning. But back in the spring, when we had our school closure and everyone was just surprised by this and scrambling to meet student needs and put together remote learning plans, that maybe some of these goals were not able to be addressed, and maybe now they can't be addressed. So if you cannot implement the entire IEP with the remote or hybrid plan that you have for your reopening, then you should come up with an alternate plan for the student. And I've seen it called different things, like a remote learning plan or individualized remote plan or an alternate learning plan. But basically, the purpose of that plan is twofold. One is to give notice to the parents of what their child's going to be receiving, because we are unable to implement the full IEP as the IEP was intended to be implemented. And so that provides notice to the parent of what you are able to provide for that student and how you're going to provide it. And then the other thing it does is it sets forth what we're doing as a free appropriate public education for the student during this time. And so there were, I was glad to see that in the ISB on August 14th released a frequently asked questions document for parents. And it specifically talked about, we've been throwing around this terminology of compensatory services, that's not an appropriate term to use with regard to COVID unless the district provided nothing to the student. And then compensatory services, which is a legal terminology when you've denied FAPE, would be that would be compensatory service if we provided nothing. But the point of writing these separate plans is to indicate what services we can provide, what goals we are going to work on during this time. And then the thought is, rather than quote unquote compensatory services, looking at a recovery service, recovering back to the student's progress when they return to school, or I've seen some people call it COVID impact services or COVID slide services. The term recovery comes from a U.S. Department of Education document. But when normal school operations resume, then we will implement the regular IEP, and we may need to make adjustments. And so it's very important during this remote and hybrid learning time to keep good data, because at some point we're going to look at the data that we had before school closure, all the data that we can compile during school closure and remote learning, and then data that we take when we come back to regular school at some point, and then determine whether the student requires different services to their IEP. Do they need additional services because they had difficulty accessing remote learning or paying attention during it? Do they need additional services because there were some goal areas that we couldn't work on? That type of thing. So it's very important also to do the best progress data reporting that you can under the circumstances to be able to assess what the student will need when we get back to normal operations. Another thing that's really important during this time is to keep in contact with the parent. One thing would be explaining these services that are in this alternate plan, trying to come to agreement with the parent, working with the parent on their schedule of services, particularly the related services. And then also, as I mentioned before, perhaps helping with behavioral assistance. So does the parent know how to do a first then schedule for the student? Could we put in place a token economy if the student needs some motivation to work during remote learning? Can we teach the parent how to do a picture schedule or incorporate breaks? But just keeping in contact with the parent to see how remote learning is going. The other thing, I've had a lot of questions about signature requirements. So, for example, if we're going to release student records, we need a consent. If we're going to do an evaluation, we need consent. So there are various things that we would need consent for. And how do we get a signature when we're remote? So what both the U.S. Department of Education has said and Illinois State Department of Education has said is that you can do this electronically. So some school districts are using things like DocuSign or Adobe, or the parent could merely send back an email stating their agreement. And we've used that, and we had some evaluations that were in process when school closed, and we were unable to do any in-person evaluations at that time. And we, in accordance with the U.S. Department of Education suggestions, since we were running out of days on our timeline for the evaluations, we got agreement from parents to extend that 60 school day timeline for the testing. And so that was done via email. The parent would send an email saying that they agreed to it. So we do have to continue with all timelines. We have to continue with all consent requirements. But we can work with parents to extend those and also to find different ways of getting that documentation. And speaking of documentation, I also wanted to point out that as of July 1, 2020, we have that 3-school-day rule is back in effect, where we need to, if we're going to have an IEP meeting or an eligibility meeting, to provide parents with the documents that are going to be discussed at that meeting, other than service and placement pages of the IEP, at least 3 school days before the meeting. And so that may be something that we'd want to email or mail, or the parent could pick it up under the revised legislation. The parent should have a choice of how they want to obtain that documentation. But we have that rule back in effect currently. We are doing a lot of evaluations now. As I mentioned, there were some that were either in progress and the evaluation had to stop. We also had some parents who requested evaluations right around the school closure time. And so we had an extensions and we're doing those now. So I have some schools who, even if they're remote, are having students come in to do some face-to-face testing, obviously with face coverings and social distancing and sanitation measures in place, but to do some of those in person. My understanding is that there's also one IQ test at least that now the test publisher has a remote version. So if you have, I have a couple situations where despite being allowed to do the in-person testing, there are some parents who have elected all remote learning and do not want to bring their student in to the school, that there may be some new possibilities now of doing remote testing, and that IQ test, the RAIS, is standardized on remote administration of the testing. So I just find that kind of interesting how we're all kind of coming together to meet the times and requirements of what we're living through now. Things like functional behavior assessments are still problematic because that really requires that student to be in the classroom and in the setting that we're trying to determine behavioral interventions for. And then the additional complication is even if we were back in the classroom and at a school that has in-person instruction now, the student's been out. It's almost like a new setting. And so what's the adjustment? You have to basically give them an adjustment period back to school. So that's an area where you'll either want to get an extension or you'll want to collect some data during remote learning, look at the data before, just with the understanding that that's something that you're going to have to come back and revisit when normal school operations resume. So those are basically the biggest issues, the remote learning plans and the evaluations, the timelines that the schools are facing in the special education area.
Well, thank you very much for that overview, Courtney. The next question that I have here is about grades. Should students learning remotely be graded on normal terms? If some students in a class are in person or others are remote, should they all be graded on the same scale?
Well, ISBE recommends that we return to traditional grading practices, but leaves that to district discretion. The other thing, and in looking at with some students being in person versus remote, that ISBE points out is that you need to take into account for students in remote learning, making sure that they have the necessary technology and tools so that we are grading fairly. And so there may be a difference in remote and in-person with live streaming. There may be a difference in that grading. And so we might be live streaming instruction. We might be posting lessons for reference, as I mentioned before. Do the students in remote learning have the same contacts and support? And accommodations should be applying both in remote learning as well as in person. So there could be differences, again, based on is the programming different for the students? Is the work the same? What's the access that the student has? Now, if you are doing all live streaming and synchronous, then maybe there doesn't need to be a difference in grading practices. But that's something within district discretion and based on the circumstances, I think.
Great. Thank you, Courtney. What about extracurriculars? If districts have chosen to go to remote learning, should they even continue with in-person extracurricular activities?
Well, they will need to consider safety, just as they're considering safety as one of those factors in determining whether they're going to have in-person or remote learning. Now, also kind of depends on where the activity is. If we're outside, then if we're social distancing, we don't have to wear masks. So that makes it easier if this is an extracurricular activity that's outside, perhaps, depending on the activity. And it may depend on how many students are in that activity. Do we have a chess club? Then we only have 5 students that have participated in any event. So that social distancing is easy. I mean, all those safety factors that you're considering and that you're transforming the school building for currently would also be considerations for the extracurricular. The other thing that I do want to point out is based on ISB guidance, if you offer the extracurricular activities and you have in-person instruction and you have students whose families have elected to have only remote learning, that you have to offer that extracurricular activity to students who are in remote learning just as you are offering it and to the same extent that you offer it to students in person. So just because they elect remote learning, if you have that in-person extracurricular activity, they could elect to do that extracurricular activity. It's kind of like that OCR ruling, which I always thought was kind of interesting, where, because it reminded me of my mother, there was a kid that was on homebound and the student on homebound wanted to come to, I believe it was a school dance, and the school said what my mother would have said. Well, if you're too sick to come to school, you're too sick to come to this activity. But OCR did not agree with that and said that even if the student is homebound, they must have the opportunity, otherwise it's discrimination, to engage in this activity. So kind of the same thing is that if we offer that extracurricular activity to in-person or hybrid students, then we have to offer it to remote learners as well.
Sure. Sure. All right. One more question here. After remote learning in the spring, there were many districts that reported that they lost contact with students and it became a lot harder for them to maintain their role as a check-in for students' well-being. How do you suggest the districts maintain their role as being able to check in on students during remote learning now, and you know, what are the appropriate boundaries to be maintained during this time?
Well, ISBE does recommend having this constant contact with parents and families to check in on both their mental and physical health needs. And one thing to determine would be, what's the best means of contacting this parent? Does this parent prefer email? Does this parent prefer a call to their cell phone? Are there certain times that the parent is available? Are there other times that are not good to contact the parent? So basically seeing what will work for the parent. And I know there have been some situations where we haven't even been able to get to that point, but trying to determine what's the best way to contact the parent and what's at the best time. The other thing that ISB has recommended is that you can use paraprofessionals to do this check-in and to provide mental health resources. So it could be a variety of people within the school doing these contacts. And as far as boundaries, it would be important to use only district-sanctioned technology. So I would not be sending contact to parents through, for example, a personal cell phone or using some district, your district email or your district phone, and also just making sure that all of your communication is appropriate. I'm sure our schools wouldn't have that problem, but again, if we're sending something in writing, such as an email, that becomes a student record. And just assessing also that, as far as boundaries, also assessing that family's comfort level and also confidentiality and privacy that family feels.
Do you think home visits would ever be appropriate?
I think so. Of course, we would have to, again, number one, make sure that the family is comfortable with that, and then also practice safe practices. So if you're going to go to their house to knock on the door and talk to them outside, then you're wearing face covering, social distancing, all of those those same requirements that we have in the community and at school.
Great. Courtney, thank you so much for your time and insight today. It is very much appreciated.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.